Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee on Tuesday, February 21st, 2017. And before I forget, I want to thank all the committee members and everybody else that put up with me last week when I was ill. And I really appreciate the understanding and the help. Hope nobody got sick. We are going to go a little bit out of order today. We have a very a presentation from Representative Bentz, and so we're going to skip around just a little bit. That one, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, members, we have two public hearings today on two bills that look at policy ideas related to affordability and an informational presentation on the same subject. Due to scheduling needs for members, we're going to hear one of the bills now and one after the informational hearing. So I'd like to start by taking up Representative Bentz's bill. So I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2474. Rep. Bentz, well, you can come up if you would. And Laura, you would give us a brief overview.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2474 would direct the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to establish by rule a process to ensure students receiving an education loan are provided annual counseling services during student orientation. Specifies counseling services must include estimate of total education loan amount, estimate of total education loan amount student will owe upon graduation, and estimate of monthly payment, including interest to service the loan.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Bentz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Cliff Bentz, State Representative, District 60. And Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing this bill. It's a common problem. All of us have heard about it. The numbers are startling, $1.2 trillion in student debt. I think it's actually more than that, about $30,000 average debt for each student. The challenge, of course, isn't the statement of the problem. The challenge is what in the world to do about it, and I've met with a number of different institutional employees, workers, people trying to figure out what to do about it. Because as you may recall, when you were in school and you were thinking about taking on debt, you might have been distracted, perhaps not aware of the burden that debt truly entails. There's some great articles, great materials on this. Everybody understands the problem. No one has the solution. This bill suggests counseling. Counseling is probably a really good thing if it's done appropriately and repeatedly, because I think as people go through school, they tend to start listening a little more as you get closer to the end. Maybe not as much when you're younger. But what we need to do something, because the burden of this crushing debt is too great, and we need to do something. Now, this people are going to say, well, counseling won't work. We're already doing counseling. There's all kinds of records, all kinds of materials available early on. But the truth of the matter is, it's not working. People are taking on debt when they shouldn't. I had a couple of witnesses who were going to be here today. Sadly, a family emergency took one away, and the other disappeared, unfortunately not wanting to talk about being deep in debt. But the truth of it is, we have a problem. And so I come here today not necessarily with a solution, but to raise the issue. I understand you have several other bills that talk about the same problem, so I'm hoping that your committee will come up with something that's not overly burdensome for the institutions, but helps some of these people avoid mistakes. I recall, I think my 4 years in college went by as more quickly than any other time I've ever spent in my life. And before you know it, you're $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 in debt. So anything we can do early on to try to head that off would be, I'm sure, something we would all be thanked for if we can figure it out. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions?
Question. Please. Would it be, thank you for your presentation, and thank you for talking about student debt. Would it be helpful to include information about it would take X amount of income to pay this off at, I don't know, 10% debt service or something like that? So in the same way that we do housing, that it shouldn't take more than 25% of your income. I think I had a student who wanted to major in guitar, but he also was going to take on $30,000 a year in student debt. I didn't think that was fair to allow him to go into that debt. So do you think proposals.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the kind of thing we should be doing. We ran some numbers. I had some of my staff run some numbers earlier today. If you're starting as a school teacher at $35,000 and you take a third out for taxes and overhead, you have about $2,000 a month left. You spend $7,000 on, or excuse me, $700 that month on rent. Leaves you $1,300. Of the $1,300, $30,000 over 10 years is around $330 a month. You've got about $500 left to live on. I mean, yes, someone needs to sit down and show people that. Now, I think I've heard this morning and yesterday from folks that do these kind of discussions at various colleges across our state, and I think they're trying. I think the problem is kids aren't listening, distracted, too busy. I suggested we do in these discussions exactly what you have to do if you're busy getting a loan for a car, because, of course, all of those things have to be called out. That's federal law. And so that you slow down before you buy that crazy machine and then find yourself in debt for the next 20 years over a car. The same thing should be true for these kinds of long-term investments. I don't want to understate the value of education. I don't think there's anything better, truly. But people, like you just said, teaching guitar is not going to pay off many bills. Very huge challenge. But I'm sure your committee's up to it, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I also want to commend you on this bill. Financial literacy is really important to me also, and I think it's really important that a student understands the commitment they're making when they're making a decision to accept loans and understand it. And I also think that maybe there's a component here that you might consider when a young person's making decisions, that they make decisions with their family. Because it's not just their loan, it becomes the family's loan. I know some institutions have calculators to help you calculate how much, similar to what my colleague here mentioned, how much income are you making, how much student loans do you need to get in order to go to school, how many hours you have to work so you can be able to pay, or mom and dad pay, because it might not be that the student's going to be paying. But it definitely having a family component and a calculator associated to helping people visually understand what they're getting themselves into when they're considering loans.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Vice Chair Leone. I would just agree with you completely. And I think part of the problem is kids are trying, I'm afraid there is a bit of a bias. If you're working for a college, then you're going to try your best to get the kid to borrow the money to go to the school. So there's an inherent conflict. On the other hand, somehow we've got to do a better job. Overcome those conflicts, and I'm sure if we look, we'll see a lot of forms that are designed to do what we're talking about, but it's not working. So we need to do something better.
Rep. Breschke.
Thank you, Chair, and Rep. Benz. Do you know what the repayment of loans are right now, what the repayment rate or what the default rate is for students? You may not know that off the top of your head. The reason I ask is I think that if you take away, if kids take out a loan, they go, oh, well, so-and-so never repaid it, they defaulted, and there's no real stick at the end of that. That's another reason people go into debt. If there's no penalty for default, then it's free money.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure it quite works that way. I think they are pursued, and I think it does ruin their credit, and I think a whole bunch of bad things do happen. I don't think those loans are dischargeable in bankruptcy.
That's my
recollection.
Exactly. Okay.
So I think that loan will be part of your life for a very long time.
Okay.
So that is the right way to say it. And I see here the default rates are called out here, and Oregon Community College default rate appears to be 20.5%.
Yeah.
And Oregon overall is 13.7%.
And thank you. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep., thanks for your work on the bill. And this is, my fourth term on the committee, and, we've worked on this issue in various ways since I've become a part of, been on the committee. One of the areas we did was, we have Aspire programs that exist in our high schools and so forth to try to, again, help students understand the cost of post-secondary education and to align their choices of institutions with where they can actually afford, rather than just maybe a place where the sun shines all the time, that sort of thing, you know. So I think that's happening out there. But I guess my question would be about the bill. You say enable the student to understand. And I guess if there's a way we could quantify to make sure, how do we know they're understanding? Is there a way to, and I don't know the answer to that. Maybe you have some ideas, but there might be a way we could tighten this up a little bit or use some other descriptive phrases in there to ensure that the message is getting through to the student and or his or her family in a way that it will be beneficial to the choices that they make.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, thank you for that comment. I have to say that the materials that I've read suggest that the only way to get through is with counseling, not with just paper and not with just something online. Somebody that actually sits the student down and says, this is how tough it's going to be to try to communicate. So how to tighten that up, we can work on it. I'm afraid that the more effective it is, the more expensive it's going to be. I think that's where we're going to encounter difficulties with our institutional colleagues.
Jean.
Go ahead, Rip.
Rip. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for bringing this forward. I do echo what Representative Alonzo Leon said about financial literacy and having a deeper understanding for students. I would even love to see us have this discussion very early on, prior to someone sitting as a senior or junior coming in to be a student, because I think that part of that conversation can be look within your district or look at these other options that can help you alleviate that debt before you graduate. Because I think a lot of times that's what we're looking at, we're facing, is the fact that there's a lot of missed time in there, that they could be taking some courses and taking some things, dual credit options, that could give them a savings. And so having, if I love the idea of this, but maybe the other part of that is the first part of the conversation is as a eighth grader with the parents and students talking about it to show them their options for high school. And then again, I just don't want them to have missed opportunity. I totally get what you're saying and I appreciate it, because they need to have that understanding. And it is a tremendous amount of debt, but I am hopeful that we can engage in that conversation and the opportunities prior to.
Chair, Representative Sullivan, your point is an excellent point, and as someone who served on the school board for 3 years, who tried unsuccessfully to impose upon all the students in Ontario HC School District the obligation to take a class on credit cards so that they could understand how damaging and dangerous credit truly is. But fighting one's way into that curriculum is quite the challenge. But your point's a very good one.
Thank you.
Yeah. We actually have some other folks to testify, and you've been so generous with your time. Unless there are other questions for Representative Bentz, and we have a couple of other bills on a similar topic, so thank you for lighting this fire, though. This is an important topic, and I think you've captured our interest, so thank you very much. So if Cindy Robert, John Wyckoff, and Tim Cohen would like to join us.
Too funny.
Chair Reardon, excuse me, Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, John Wyckoff with the Oregon Community College Association. I'd first like to thank Representative Bentz and the committee for their attention to this issue. Student loan debt is something that our colleges are keenly aware of and very concerned about. There's a lot of good stuff in all three of the concepts that are currently out there on this issue. Wanted to just kind of hit on some of the issues in this one. The one sort of concern in the current language that we would have is currently the federal government is not allowing colleges to do mandatory loan counseling beyond entrance and exit loan counseling. And so a lot of the colleges have tried to experiment with non-mandatory forms of counseling, In fact, one of our colleges actually was, for a period, attempting mandatory counseling, and the federal government asked them to please cease and desist. In a 2014 report by the Association of Community College Trustees, they looked at this issue and voiced some skepticism in the effectiveness of non-mandatory counseling. And sort of looking at those sorts of concerns, the Department of Education started an experiment in 2016 where colleges could enter into that experiment and look at the effectiveness of these non-mandatory programs. I think the hope is that if they are proven not to be as effective as mandatory programs, that they will loosen up on that requirement and start allowing colleges to do that on a mandatory annual basis. We think that would be a good thing and a good change to make. Some of the things that we can do currently, and so I think some of the other concepts deal with this, not so much this one, but it would be possible, for example, to give annual information about if a student is taking loans, what they would have to pay off over time. What we can't do is, once a student starts their degree, say by the end of the 4 years, here's what you will owe and here how much you'll have to pay back, like you might with a mortgage or a car payment. And the reason for that is just simply that in college loans, they are an annual loan, and the amount may change every year, or very likely will change every year. So it's very difficult to predict at the beginning what that total amount will be and give students useful information. But you could do that on an annual basis. The other little bit of a complication there is repayment plans are vastly different. You can do a graduated repayment plan where you pay a little bit at the beginning and it goes up as you go. You can pay sort of through the standard plan. And what our financial aid directors have said back is what would be fairly easy to do, well, would be to look at, to let students know on an annual basis, here's what your on a standard plan your repayment would look like. And so that would be possible to do. And that wouldn't be anything that would currently, we believe, run us into any trouble with the Department of Education. Just to touch on a couple of questions, or one of the questions that came up, the colleges do use student debt calculators on their websites. SALT is currently the one that I think the most of our campuses use. It's not an acronym; it's just called SALT.
SALT was the original currency.
Oh, okay.
That's why.
Now I know. with that, I would be happy to conclude my testimony and take any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Wyckoff? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. We're 18 schools. They're private, nonprofit schools like the one across the street. We have 35,000 students total. 20% of Oregon's undergraduate enrollment is in our schools, and 45% of the state's graduate school students are in our schools. 32% of our students receive Pell Grants, and 92% of our students receive some sort of financial aid. So I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things. First of all, what you were just being told about the loan repayment plans and how we can do that annually. I would only argue that we don't have access to information about private loans. We do not have the ability to tell a student how much they're going to have to pay the year after they get out of the school, or the year after that, or the year after that, because we do not, for privacy reasons, have any access to private loan information. What we do have is federal loan information, and I wanted to share with you some of the information on the kind of truth in lending style requirements that student loans have that are put on by the federal government. Oregon's nonprofit institutions don't actually do the loans themselves. They don't finance anything. What they do is financial aid. They give you grants and scholarships that don't have to be paid back. And they let you know information about your federal grants, but we're just a facilitator. All the federal student loans impose their own mandatory entrance counseling for borrowers. So not just a form you have to sign, there's entrance and exit counseling that has to occur. The federal government's counseling rules require schools to either provide the students with the counseling or assure that they have done the counseling online. I gave you a couple different forms there. One of the top ones is a financial aid letter from Lewis and Clark that lays out how much the school costs, and I just read that myself. and how much federal aid the person who would have received that letter could have received. So you can get a sense of what it is that we do. We're just putting information together. But prior to distributing a federal student loan, we have to make sure that the student has completed the necessary master promissory note and classes that go with it. That's on the studentloans.gov line. And I actually included some information on the promissory notes and the requirements of that program within your packet. At that site, the students find comprehensive reviews, the terms of their loans, and important financial literacy concepts such as managing money while in college, repaying student loans, and avoiding defaults. So we're already making sure they get that information at entry. The federal government requires it, and whether we do it ourselves or the student gets it offline, the schools are required to document that the student has completed the required counseling before they get their money. We also, at many of the Lions schools, participate in SALT, which you were just being told about, and that makes available a neutral third party to consult with students, tell them how to manage the debt, help them to figure out their calculations. The student would have to give that person their private loan information in order to be really thorough. But we do offer that. Most of our schools are involved in that program that offers this third party to really help kids feel better about the loans they're taking. One of the things that really caught me in the beginning when Representative Benz was speaking was when he said, kids just don't listen. So true. I have two teenagers of my own. It's absolutely true. And I wish you could figure out a way to legislate my children listening to me, because then my life would be so much easier, but we can't. What we can do is figure out different ways to access the students, whether it's by a calculator, a cool app, a form, one-on-one counseling online, counseling in our office. The best we can do is give them different ways of learning the information. And I think most of the schools in Oregon would tell you, actually, I think all the schools in Oregon would tell you, we're doing that, because it's really important to us as well. Thank you.
Yeah. Any questions? Ms. Coleman?
Chairman Ritter, committee members, I'll be brief. My testimony is based on what happened with my children. The first one is student debt has went up from about $300 billion to $1.1 trillion based on New York Times in 2014. One of the things that was difficult was for the student to know how much the education cost, because it wasn't included time away from work. So they weren't able to work in addition to that. The other thing that it didn't do is it didn't explain to them what impact that would have in the future. President of one university that spoke at our Rotary Club said it was an average of 10 years to pay off their student debt. My son, who was a teacher, had to get a master's degree to continue to teach. The degree cost a lot of money, and he does not pay hardly anything on principal because it's all interest. There'll be sometimes the debt is as much as purchasing a home. His wife is a teacher, and he is a teacher, as I mentioned, about $70,000 each. That's a very expensive, and I don't know that they knew what that impact was going to be when they got married and wanted to have a family. As I mentioned, interest alone, that's all they do is pay interest. Now, the other question is, what does it do with a credit check? If they're a delinquent, what does that do to them? If they have a lot of private loans, what does that do to them when they want to purchase a home or do anything else with debt? Because a student loan privately can have quite an impact on their credit in the future also, and future purchases. That's all I really wanted to tell you is the impact it has on their life. And if included in this, if they could also talk about private loans, that would really be important to me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions, comments? Yeah, Rep. Johnson.
Thanks, Chair. Sandy, you probably don't know the answer to this, but are there other testifiers from the universities coming in? Do we know?
No.
Okay.
This is it.
To what level of, you know, I like what you show from the privates to the publics go through a process that's similar, and it's not a question, I guess, for you. It should be for them, but I would like to know if we have a similar process in place at our universities that have the same sort of
We have two other bills coming that are on the same topic. So.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, if I might, Rep. Johnson, they're actually the same. The federal requirements for federal loans are the same across the board. So they do the same process we do. And again, there may be different tools at the school to help students get information, like our SALT program, but we're all required to do the same thing and document that the students have taken that counseling.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Chair Reardon, I have a quick comment.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that from the federal government, you do get it at the entrance and at the exit. Mm-hmm. And I think that for students to internalize the debt, it's almost like you need a revision every year or every other year to make sure they truly understand the impact of a loan is on themselves and their family. So I like the idea of making sure we have continuous information for them. Certainly, you mentioned your kids not listening. So they may prepare for this loan at the very beginning and then out of sight, out of mind. Mm-hmm. And they keep acquiring money or loans and then not really paying attention to, deciding to take all the loans as opposed to working part-time if they can. Making that as an option. Anyways, I just wanted to make that comment because I think it's important that we need to be mindful that this continuous education of financial literacy and understanding the impact of taking out loans is on oneself.
Well, and it's also money that doesn't get pumped back into, buying that house, buying that car, so it's not going back into the community either. So it's also a kind of drag on our economy as well. We will be having a couple of other hearings on a similar topic to my committee. If there's anybody that wants to take a look at all three of those and kind of get their heads around it and volunteer, that would be it'd be helpful. But, other than that, if there's no other Rep. Klum.
It's Mr. Chair, let me just pull this up. It's the student loan affordability calculator. It doesn't spell out SALT. I'm still trying to come up with what SALT stand for.
The student
affordability loan.
Liability.
Yeah.
No, it's not. It's not the word SALT, but the student. I have the information right here. So the student loan assistance site is, in fact, the financial literacy program. They do a lot of different things. But SALT, the program specific to the colleges, SALT does not stand for anything.
I'm uncomfortable with that. I feel like it should.
Representative, it uses the SLA, just like SLA in it, just like the website, but because it was the original currency in the world, salt was.
I think
so
it's because
I'll
it's
buy you lunch with some salt tomorrow.
Mr. Chair.
Let's Chair. Move on. That's,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Rep. Bynum.
Down here.
Rep. Bynum.
So, I'm not sure that the committee room can see what we have, but you have given us information that 1 year costs $57,000 mm-hmm. to attend this university. Yes?
No, that's the...
Mr. Chair, Representative Bynum, that was information that was in fact provided to me that I could use an example here. Would I have liked it to be less? Yes, but it's not, and it's just be honest.
So I just want to make it clear, we are allowing in our state children to take on four times $57,000 potentially in liability if they don't get financial aid of some sort. That's almost $240,000 for an education that I am not sure always pays back $240,000.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Bynum, I think that's a very interesting policy conversation to have. I will tell you this, though. When people graduate from the Alliance schools, the average debt is $24,000. It's the same amount as someone going to a private public school in Oregon. So I offer the numbers to show you how we do it, but please don't let it indicate that that's actually what those students are paying.
Thank if you. I'm reading this correctly, I think that the top set of numbers is there's a number of grants and loans and so forth.
Yep.
The other number, the 61.5, is the bill for that year. So is it the difference that they're paying? The difference plus the loans.
My point.
So this is confusing to.
It is confusing,
adults.
But I think Representative Point's well taken.
Yeah.
We charge a lot for school. A lot of schools.
That is
that's
the
not
point.
The point.
That's
it's,
your point.
That
we
is,
appreciate
that. That is the point. And children. Families without money are not able to access a $60,000 education as easily as someone.
But I can't tell whether it's really 60 or is it 4 or is it 6 or 10 from the way this is laid out. Just and I'm reading it in front of a committee, so the format of it is a little bit challenging. So, Rep. Johnson, and then we'll better
question for Cindy. Would you happen to have any information about the four-year graduation rates for the independents versus the public universities in Oregon? Just
so the graduation rates for the and I'll get you new fact sheets when we do our piece. But I think the graduation rates for the four-year line of schools, I have it right back there, is like 52% for 4 years, 56%. I can get it.
That's okay.
I will be getting you those facts. But I just wanted to point out that there is not a huge differential in how much debt a student takes on at an alliance school.
Okay. Two more real quick questions. Rep. Hurd, are you still on?
No.
Okay. Still quick.
Thank you, Chair. Am I correct in saying that I think that Oregon is number 46 in the money that they invest in higher education? Is that 46?
Or Representative Willis, I'm going to answer the answer because they don't invest in.
Okay.
Chair Reardon, Representative Solomon, we have been right around there. I'm not sure currently this year, after sort of the last legislative session where we landed, but we have been anywhere from about 48th. I know 4 years ago, I think we were at 48th, but yes, I believe we are still right around there.
Okay, thank
and
it, you.
And that includes total financial aid, public universities, community colleges. It's an inclusive number of higher education spending.
Thank you.
Okay, now we're working a bill between Williamson and McLean about committee bills.
The 501 Pell Grant, and this is courtside. Right, so this is like an opportunity.
Need to hold off on this.
If you're a middle-income kid,
not a problem.
If you're a middle-income kid,
any other comments? Thank you all for testifying. I suspect we will see you again. I hope so. Thank you. And I am closing public hearing on House Bill 2474. Yeah. So we'll give just scratch this. Do I need to say anything about that? Okay. Good news. It seems we have two bills ready to go for work sessions today, a Rep. Wisnett bill and a Rep. Witt bill. So we'll vote on those at this time. And so I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2220. Laura, if you'd please give us a little reminder on what that's about.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2220 relates to veterans and high school diplomas. It would remove the requirement that veterans must not have graduated high school due to service in the armed services for issuance of a high school diploma, removes the requirement that veterans must have received the general education development certificate, post-secondary degree, or minimum score on the armed services vocational aptitude battery for issuance of a high school diploma.
Do you have that motion? Yeah. Okay. I would entertain a motion on this.
Okay. Chair Reardon, I move HB 2220 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Rep. Alonzo Leon moves House Bill 2220 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Whoa. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, honorable committee members, if you remember this bill, what it did is just to remove some things, restrictions on veterans that they could get the diploma. Also, I've been asked because of a statement we got on the fiscal impact that the legislature from, this is from LFO, I'd like to read it for you. The legislation has no fiscal impact to the Department of Education. However, the LFO believes that the ramification of the measure and the impacts of school districts cannot be fully quantified, and therefore fiscal impact cannot be determined. They talk about it depends on how many people actually apply. And if you remember our testimony we received from the Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs, they said it would probably only be people in the Vietnam era, because then the military started requiring GED or graduation. So I'm pretty comfortable that there will not be any financial impact. But so I still urge your vote, yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Further discussion? Okay, if we could do a roll call.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye. Assume you'd like to carry that.
Aye. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Solomon.
Aye.
Vice Chair Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett. Aye.
Chair Rittich.
Aye. And Rep. Wisnett, would you care to carry that? Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right. Thank you. So the motion passes. Rep. Wisnett's on board to carry that. And so thank you, committee. Okay, I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2565. Laura, please provide the information. A little review.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2565 would modify the priority enrollment system to offer course registration to continuing qualified students prior to continuing non-qualified students within the same credit year classification. It requires public universities and community colleges to accommodate priority registration for new qualified students.
Oops, I already gave it to you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Vice Chair, wasn't it?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2565 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Rep. Wisnett moves House Bill 2565 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, roll call, please. Oops, I'm sorry.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Did we hear from the colleges how they would accommodate this, just what it would look like? And I see John Wyckoff's not here anymore, so apparently they don't have a lot of to add to it. But in reality, how that might work out. But I'm not super concerned about it, but I don't know that we have heard directly from the colleges about how they might administer this.
And I think we heard something from registrars, and I don't have the details on registrar from OSU has contacted us, and it's not a big, not didn't seem to be a big concern.
Okay, I'll let it go then. So,
okay, thank you. Appreciate that. Okay, where are we at? Are we voting? Or?
Roll call. Yeah.
Okay, no further discussion. Do a roll call.
Representative Bynum? Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Johnson?
Aye.
Representative
Reschke?
Aye.
Representative
Solman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lindsay Leon?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair
Reardon? Aye. Motion passes. And we'll see if we can get Rep. Witt to carry this for us. Thank you, sir. Okay. And how much time do we have? Doing pretty good on it. Okay, great. All right, I'm opening an informational hearing. And for this informational hearing, we've invited Heck back to continue our conversation of affordability, access to higher education, and we've invited the universities to give us a review of state funding for higher education. So, Mr. Cannon, would you join us, please? Okay. And we do need to kind of end this session by 4:25, 4:30, somewhere in there. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for the invitation again to be here and to continue our conversation about affordability and specifically higher education funding today. And that really will be the focus of my presentation, both in the interest of time and because of the expertise that will follow me from the public universities. I want to encourage you to focus many of your sort of questions and discussion on their presentation. They'll be further kind of articulating some of the themes that I bring up here. So, of course, I want to respond to any question that you may have for me, but I also want to encourage you to direct some of those questions to them, where a lot of the expertise on these issues also lies. So I thought what I would do at the invitation of the chair was just very quickly describe for you the sort of state of the state budget for higher education, how higher education in Oregon is funded from the state. This pie chart represents the total state general fund and lottery fund budget. So this is everything that's in the GFLF for the current biennium. And the red sliver is all of our higher education investments, roughly 10% of the total. That includes everything from debt service on previously approved capital projects to scholarship funds and our funding for community colleges and universities. And that all comes through the HEC to the institutions. This now takes that red sliver, that about $1.8 billion or 9.7%, and divides it, shows it sort of divided up between the main funding streams that the HEC administers for higher education. The reason there are two bars, the top bar here is the governor's recommended budget for the upcoming biennium in the 2015. The lower bar is the current budget for the current biennium, and they're pretty close. But you can see the major categories starting from the left are state-funded debt service. So these are, again, commitments that we've made in capital investments, bonds. The state has sold proceeds for which benefit our community colleges and our universities for capital projects. We have debt service to pay on those bonds. You see a fairly notable growth from 15-17 to 17-19 as the result of projects that were approved in the last biennium or in the last legislative session. We see here the state financial aid in red. So these are the major programs that we administer, primarily the Oregon Promise and the Oregon Opportunity Growth Grant. And you see the growth proposed in the governor's recommended budget for our state programs investing directly in student financial aid. And then you see the two brown and yellow are the primary funding, state funding streams for our community colleges and our public universities, respectively. So they represent the bulk of the state higher education budget, the Community College Support Fund and the Public University Support Fund. The blue represents other investments in the universities. They're detailed, the public universities, they're detailed in the footnote. And the remaining bars are investments in OHSU, small general fund and lottery fund investments in workforce, and the final sliver, representing just a couple percent of the total, is the operations of the state agency. The HEC, in turn, takes the major funding streams, and I'm going to focus now on the red, the brown, and the yellow, and the HEC determines how to divvy it up to our institutions or to our students in the case of scholarships. So with the Public University Support Fund, we, the commission, supported by its staff, adopts a formula that determines how those dollars, that roughly $667 million of public university support, is invested. And the main takeaway from this slide is that we invest in students in ways that both reflect their progress towards degree completion, their success, as well as their underlying enrollment, and we invest in the missions of the institutions. This is a formula, and I'm not getting into the complexity here, but it's a formula that rewards student outcomes as well as student enrollment, and it provides base support to each institution based on its particular mission. For the Community College Support Fund, it is primarily an enrollment-driven formula, so we tally up the amount of full-time equivalent funding, and most of the formula, most of the state investment, is awarded to our 17 colleges on a per FTE basis, with a couple of exceptions that are noted here, sort of carve-outs for some base funding and categorical funding that comes first. For students, you're aware that our two primary programs, one is need-based, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, so we award scholarships to the lowest income students attending public or private qualifying institutions in Oregon. The Oregon Promise, the smaller version, the much smaller program in dollar terms, focused on community college students, direct from high school students, and it's a universal program, so it serves students without respect to need. Back to the sort of question of funding, state funding adequacy. You've seen, I think, a variant of this slide previously, but this is the trajectory since 1999, inflation adjusted, of state investment in universities and community colleges directly. It's overall shows sort of significant ups and downs, particularly on the university side. The universities will likely have versions of this. The numbers may be slightly different. The notes here will depict why we've incorporated debt service, which has grown to be an increasing proportion of this total investment in universities as the state's gone more to capital and away from some of the operating support that the state used to provide much more of.
Just to help emphasize your point, I trust that's not adjusted for inflation or anything.
Okay. Representative Reardon, this is, in fact, adjusted for inflation.
Yes.
So this is all expressed in sort of current year dollars.
And, okay, thank you.
It emphasizes that point. This is basically the same data, and I know I presented a version of this. The green bar is that total sort of state appropriation in higher education. Going, this is for Oregon, going back now to 1990. Again, inflation adjusted. This is actually using, unfortunately, a slightly different inflation index, but nevertheless, the same idea. It's been inflation adjusted. This reflects our total investment. So this lumps community colleges and universities and financial aid all together and shows that the overall diminishing levels of state investment adjusted for inflation since 1990, the brown bar that sits on top, we talked about this a little last time, are the tuition revenues that our institutions have grown in order to maintain capacity even as state investment has shrunk. So this reflects the cost shift from the state to the student since 1990 as the state has in inflation adjustment and on FTE terms has diminished its investment. Red line here reflects growing enrollment in higher education. All of these numbers are on a per student basis, so that contributes to that diminishing per student investment by the state. This number was alluded to in the last presentation. This is Oregon ranking 45th, I think, in educational appropriations per student. So as we look at that green bar on the last slide and say, well, how do we fare today relative to other states? We fare quite poorly. On the other hand, I'm sorry, one more on that point. That gap between the national average of state funding per student and the Oregon investment per student is a couple of $1,000. You can see it's held steady over the last few years, roughly steady, but that's the big gap between $5,000 and roughly $7,000 in the national average of state appropriations per student. I suppose the good news, or the silver lining, albeit potentially a brief one, is that in 2015, at a time of reinvestment, the state significantly increased its investment in higher education, growing that per student funding nearly 25%. That data, what I'm just describing to you, that 2015 reinvestment, is not reflected in these national comparisons, which haven't yet been updated for every state. When they are, we expect Oregon will move much higher than 45th in that national ranking. And so there is a positive momentum coming out of the 2015 legislative session and the current biennium. When it comes to our investments in scholarships and need-based aid, Oregon likewise is in the bottom third. We invest about less than half of the national average in scholarship funding and grant funding by the state for need-based grants. And you see that expressed here both on a per capita basis. That's the $14 per Oregonian that we invest in the opportunity grant relative to a national average of $32 per person, and we've also shown that here on the in terms of the per 18 to 24 year old. Also note here at that final sort of call out, the opportunity grant, which is our main state investment in need-based aid, primarily supports our public colleges and universities. 92% of the dollars are awarded to students attending public colleges and universities. I was asked by the chair and Representative Wisnett to spend just a couple of moments reviewing some of the findings from our study in 2015, or as a result of the passage of House Bill 2973 in 2015, about creating affordable baccalaureate degree paths. Chair, I can continue on with those final three slides now or come back to it later. This is just in response to the Representative Wisnett's request that we review kind of the findings that we had about affordable degree paths.
He's been called out unexpectedly, so if we could wait for him to come back.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
happy to return for that if the time permits.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Cannon? As always, excellent, thorough, informative.
Thanks.
And appreciated.
Chair, this may not fit in this context, but at some point it would be good to talk about how the heck a shift into an outcomes-based funding model, which is pretty dramatic, too, that happened in the last couple of years. But maybe that's a part of a different presentation.
Great.
And what the intent is and what the hope for outcomes are and all of that kind of stuff.
Representative Johnson, Chair Reardon, we'd be happy to do a deep dive on that. This slide gives a very high-level view of the ways in which our new public university support fund allocation model incorporates student outcomes and does so very significantly in coming years. We're still in a transition period, but the upcoming year will be one where a very significant portion of the support fund is awarded on the basis of student outcomes, with weighting for underrepresented students and for higher cost and higher demand degrees, such as degrees in the STEM fields and bilingual teacher preparation and other high demand areas. So we'd be very happy to talk about that, and it'd be interesting to hear also from the institutions about the way in which that model is helping drive their decision.
Yeah, exciting development.
If you had to do an elevator speech on this presentation and sum it up in the time it takes to go to the fourth floor, what would you say about the state's level of funding for higher ed over the last 15 years?
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, the state significantly lags the national average in investment in higher education, and that has resulted in a very significant cost shift to students through tuition. We made great strides in 2015, and it's a question of whether that momentum can be sustained.
And that was the message I got out of this, so thank you for summing it up.
Thank you, Chair. Senate, did I read that University of Oregon is looking at a 10.6% tuition increase?
Representative Solman, Chair Reardon, you'll hear in a moment from a representative of the University of Oregon who can confirm that, but yes, I believe that is the proposal.
Great. Thank you so much, Ben. Appreciate
Thanks.
It. Okay, and we do have a presentation from the universities, so if Kevin Reynolds from Portland State, Brian Fox from Oregon Tech, and Jamie Moffat from U of O.
I have a question.
Save your hard questions, I hope.
Good afternoon, Chair Reardon and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Reynolds. I'm a Vice President of Finance Administration at Portland State University, and I'm joined by my counterparts from University of Oregon and Oregon Institute of Technology. And we're here today to talk a little bit about university budgeting and to answer any questions you might have about our university budgeting. And so today, briefly, we want to talk a little bit about an overview of the student populations, sort of historically and looking forward at our universities, and some of the economic impacts our universities had. We will look a little bit at the state budget history. We'll be focusing on that public university support fund. We'll be focusing on other revenue streams, like how we get from parking and other things. And then we'll talk in some detail about the institutional budget structure and some of the cost drivers that the universities are facing.
Great. Thank you, Kevin, for the Chair Reardon, for the record, Brian Fox, Vice President for Finance at Oregon Tech. I'll walk through at the get-go to this just a little overview of who our students are and some of the challenges and opportunities that represents for the institution. I think that's an important context before we start talking about the budgets. It's really who do we serve. Thank you. I want to make a note that a significant amount of the students at Oregon's public universities come from minority backgrounds. You know, we all recognize that the growth population in Oregon really is around Hispanic students as well as Native American and African American students. And those student populations are they're growing, and they pose a particular challenge to institutions. They historically have not accessed higher education at the same rates as their white and Asian peers. And when there, oftentimes have not been as successful. And sometimes that's coming from high schools which have not prepared them to be effective in a collegiate environment. Sometimes that is coming from first-generation families, where oftentimes they just haven't grown up around higher education, so that makes it more difficult in the transition time. It's clear that these students have the capacity and the capability to be successful, but it's about providing the services that allow them to be effective. So, you know, I wanted to note that about 40% of the undergraduate and graduate populations of our institutions, these numbers are across the system, come from minority backgrounds. What's not included in here are students from the rural populations, who oftentimes have similar issues, not coming from high schools where they're spending a lot of time on college campuses, or from first-generation families. We'll move to the next slide. This is data that actually is talking about the pipeline of young Oregonians coming up. And if you'll note the colors probably don't contrast as well as they could, but that blue kind of middle section that's growing is the Hispanic population in Oregon. And this is the current and then anticipated number of graduates coming from Oregon high schools. And what you'll notice there is that the growth is really coming from that Hispanic population, one that all our institutions are significantly focused on. Those are our students. Those are our clients of the future. These numbers, and I'll channel Ben Cannon here, these numbers actually underrepresent the change in the Hispanic population in Oregon, particularly the young Hispanic population, in that this uses the current graduation rates to forecast out. And the graduation rates for young Hispanics is significantly below some of their peer racial and ethnic groups. And so this actually, that growth undercounts some of the real change in Oregon. And if we'll go to the next slide. These are Pell-eligible resident students. So this is a question of how many, what proportion of our overall students come from a low-income background. So if you hear a higher ed person talking about a low-income student, what they're really saying is someone who is Pell-eligible. Pell is a major affordability or means-tested grant program from the federal government to students. And you'll see a significant growth over time from the early 2000s or mid-2000s to 2011, 12, 13. Moving up from about 33% or about a third of our resident students coming from low-income backgrounds to about 45-46%. We've seen that back down over the last couple of years, which is a trend that that we're focused on. You know, there are a couple drivers there. One is, as we've seen tuition move up, low-income students are much more sensitive to those price increases. And the second one being that as the economy heats up, those students tend to be sort of more willing to move directly into the labor force as there's more opportunity there. So higher ed in many ways is a counter-cyclical industry. So as the economy's down, students tend to come to us. As the economy goes up, students tend to move into the private economy.
Just one quick question to see. What on the Pell grants, do you have, can you tell us the what level at which you are no longer eligible for a Pell grant, or just roughly?
Yeah, I don't have an exact number. My understanding is that, and we can follow up with this, my understanding is that it changes depending on the sort of family status. So if you have multiple dependents, so if you have three children in your family, it's a higher income threshold than one, but we can follow up with better
information. Would it be possible to say it's targeted at, does it help the middle class is what I'm really trying to find out? Whatever that is.
There isn't a sharp cliff. It tapers off, but I will say, and Jamie, you may have comments on this from the University of Oregon. I know you've spoken on it before, but oftentimes the students, it is very difficult for middle-income students to afford university because they are not eligible. I was a student like this who was not eligible for significant amounts of need-based financial aid, but also didn't come from a family who had the means or capacity to fund my education, and that is true for many of our students.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
that, I think I'll turn it back over to Kevin.
Great. So we've heard quite a bit this afternoon already about student debt. So one of the things I asked some of our folks to do was to actually break down and understand who carries the debt, actually, and when they graduate from the universities. So this is a breakdown. This looks at a group of students who graduate in 2014 and 15 from Portland State University. We've done similar analysis for students who came directly to us, and the numbers are a little bit different, but not significantly. So a couple of things you notice, you can break it out as PAL-eligible or non-PAL-eligible students. And you look at the in-state numbers there, you can see the in-state students, those who come, resident students, $23,000 is their average debt. But if you are an in-state non-eligible student, you can see that those students are leaving with $9,000 worth of debt. So a huge difference when you look at sort of debt numbers. And you can again see when you look at out-of-state, we charge more for out-of-state students, and they do leave with higher levels of debt, but still not significantly, because our out-of-state students do tend to be wealthier. So, you can actually see the sort of breakdown for about just over 50% of our in-state and out-of-state students who are non-eligible leave with no debt at all. So the debt doesn't come out. You hear these averages, but the debt's quite heavily localized, and particularly with PAL-eligible students. So we want to move quickly to economic development in terms of the universities. So our primary mission is one of education, one of providing workforce training. You can see a list of the top 10 employees of folks coming out of Portland State University. We turn out engineers, scientists, healthcare workers, teachers, social workers, which is incredibly important for workforce development. Those folks stay and work in Oregon. We have a number of other different kinds of workforce and economic impacts for us. One of those is we have a business accelerator. It's been around for quite a few years. It has won numerous awards. And some of the intellectual property, some of the inventions and discoveries from our universities have then turned into small startup companies. And those are then seeded into that incubator. And we also provide advice programming for other small startup companies as well. We've given you several other slides about the economic impact from all the other universities, but in the interest of time, we'll just move on to University of Oregon.
And this group has all read all of the slides ahead of time because they're...
Oh.
Yeah. I'll get it next week in Ways and Means.
Fantastic. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jamie Moffitt, and I'm the Vice President for Finance and Administration at the University of Oregon. And the impacts for our campus are similar in terms of, I think, what you'll see in terms of the community and the state. Falling into kind of four general themes, we do bring a lot of jobs to the community in terms of jobs directly at the university as well as those that are created by the economic activity from the university. We do pull in a lot of out-of-state revenue in terms of out-of-state non-residents as well as visitors to the state. We also obviously have a big impact in terms of providing an educated workforce for the state and really helping to fuel that pipeline of the future Oregonians for the state. And then finally, we wanted to just emphasize the startup entities that come out of the university, new technology, new ideas, et cetera. I think we don't talk about this enough, to be honest, and I think the easiest way to get your head around it is to think about what would the state look like if you didn't have the seven institutions there? What would the economic activity look like? And I think that helps to just get a sense of that magnitude.
May I ask a question? Mm-hmm. Your research money, is that mainly federal money?
The bulk of it is federal research grants, yes, that come
any,
in and fund
any
research.
Any concerns about the future of research money?
I'm probably not the best person to espouse on that, but I would say that whenever you have changes in administration, I think there are concerns about directions where people might head. I'm sure if our vice president for research was here, he could speak more on a more detailed basis about that. But we are doing a lot to try to actively encourage our grant applications are going up. We're trying to encourage faculty to make sure that they're putting in applications for obviously the most kind of important and cutting edge issues.
And in revenue from outside the state, I don't know what that means.
Yeah, so this is all based on economic report that Tim Dewey puts together for the university that shows the economic impact. And it's looking at, for instance, the dollars that non-resident students bring into the state when they come with their tuition revenue, with their housing revenue. They go and they eat everywhere, all those impacts that it has to okay. the state, as well as visitors who come in associated with those non-resident students, whether it's for orientation, graduation, all those things are bringing economic activity into the state.
Gotcha. Okay. So.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 10,270 people employed by the University of Oregon. How many are actually in the classroom or professors? And how many student employees have you been hiring at what salary? And will that change with the new minimum wage?
Yes, so Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to respond to that, of the 10,000, roughly speaking, about 2,000 of those are faculty members. We have, and I'm giving you rough numbers because it's kind of off the top of my head, we have roughly speaking about 1,200 officers of administration. Those are people that can range from advisors, counselors. You think of administrators as high-level administrators, but it's folks, anyone who supervises anyone else is in that category. So it can be a broad range of people on campus. We then have about, off the top of my head again, around 1,300 classified staff members that do a broad range of activities on campus. There's another probably 1,400 graduate students who help teaching in the classroom, so I'd add that to the 2,000. And then the remainder are student workers who work in a whole variety of different jobs. We did see an impact, to answer your question directly, on the minimum wage, where some of our budgets associated with student workers, as the minimum wage went up, that had an impact on how many hours could be hired out of those budgets. And so that did have an impact. We did not see as big of an impact on our regular staff because they're generally above those minimum levels. But as you look forward, we'll see impacts going forward.
Thank you for that reply.
Thank you, Chair and Ms. Moffitt. I also have a question about the 10,200 employees. Namely, do you have historical numbers on that? So if we went back and looked at 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago, would that number be roughly the same? Would it be half that amount? What would that look like?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can tell you that it would be increasing over time. What I can't tell you is, off the top of my head, those are not numbers I could pull in this, okay, this setting, but we can certainly get you information.
Okay, thank you.
And we do have a slide at the end where we're going to talk about some of the areas where we have felt really compelled to make investments in more staff, and we have a slide on that that we'll discuss related to student success and safety and Title IX and those types of issues.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. Moving along, the next section that we wanted to talk about is the history, the state budget history, and you've seen some slides already that talk about this. I will do my best to coordinate the data I'm going to show you with data you've just seen so that hopefully it'll feel consistent. If you move to the next slide, this chart is basically looking, you saw the slide, the pie chart that showed the percentage of higher ed as a percent of the overall state budget. What this is doing is it's giving you a historical perspective. So the blue bars represent the growing overall state budget on a biennial basis. The red line represents the percent of that is invested in the public university. So I do want to be clear, this is different than the figure you saw earlier, which was all of higher ed and included community colleges and other budgets. So you'll see over this time period, which is roughly 30 years, the sharp decrease in the percent of the budget invested in the public universities. And this does include the debt service, the operating funds, as well as the funding that comes to us for statewide programs. We do appreciate at the very end, there's a little bump up, and I just do want to acknowledge that we appreciate that support, but there has been a dramatic decline over this overall time period.
It's hard to perceive from here, the bump up.
Yeah, well, it's there. You'll see it a little bit more on this slide, I think, which will help. This is a deeper dive into the operating funds that we receive on a per-student FTE basis. The good news on this slide is that we have, over the last several years, seen an increase, which, again, we're very grateful for. The issue to keep in context, though, as you look at this slide, is that these are not CPI-adjusted numbers. These are nominal numbers. And so over this time period, you'll see that we still are at a lower funding level per student in the 15-16 year than we were in 06-07. And when you think about all the increases that we've had in terms of labor costs and healthcare costs and pension costs, those types of things, that has put extreme pressure on the budget overall. And these are averages across all of the public universities, the slides that you've seen. If you flip the slide, then the next page, this is a UO-specific analysis, but the trends that you'll see, I think, are very comparable to those that my colleagues have experienced on their campuses. What it's showing is how does the amount of money that's provided by the state per student vary with the amount of money that the student is asked to contribute in tuition. And over this time period, which is roughly speaking 20 years, we've seen this real reversal where the state used to contribute a larger share of that funding. That's that blue line that's going down. And the student was responsible for a shorter, smaller amount, and that actually flipped over time. Kind of generally speaking, a lot of people think of it as two-thirds, one-third. Mm-hmm. The state used to pick up two-thirds. Now they're picking up one-third. The thing I will point out, however, these are, by the way, CPI-adjusted figures, is that for resident students, and that's what this analysis is, when you look at the amount that we receive from the state and the amount the student pays, that does not cover the full cost of educating that resident student. The only way that we're able to educate that resident student is by charging non-residents more and bringing in non-residents who subsidize that resident education. And our estimate is it's about $5,000 to $6,000 a student.
Do you have a forecast on those numbers changing or staying the same? Any concern?
The challenge that we have, if you look particularly on my campus with tuition and we compare to other schools across the country, our non-resident tuition is right at or even slightly above market. And so while in the past we've seen significant increases and we've still seen significant students coming, I will tell you that for our campus, we're in a challenging situation right now where if we were to raise that non-resident tuition too much, we could see a significant impact in terms of our overall revenue of how many non-resident students are coming. So there's a challenge there that might make those dynamics more difficult going forward.
Thank you.
And I would add, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, the universities, it's a highly competitive field, and so there's a lot of discounting that goes on between universities and across state lines as well. So.
Very good. Thank you. Yeah, let's go. Start. Yeah. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask about that because the thank you for your presentation. I wanted to ask if the price that a family sees for the cost, the alleged cost of tuition, is that a real number, or are we using financial aid and non-resident resident rates to somewhat play a shell game, kind of? Are we mixing and matching so that you don't really have a true cost?
Chair Reardon, Representative Bynum, on our calculators, we put out the actual price, tuition and mandatory fees. We put out the estimated cost of housing and the cost of books. And then from that, then that's when you work on financial aid and packaging. So we put full, what you might want to call a full sticker price.
Right. So the full sticker price, I think, that our earlier guest gave us is not the sticker price that students are paying. Not all students are paying that, but you're starting at 60,000 and then working your way for different students to get them through.
Chair Reardon, Representative Bynum, I would again sort of make sure we sort of, it depends how you look at it. Certainly, I think across our campuses, our sort of tuition and mandatory fees, which all students would pay, are somewhere in the sort of $8,000 to $10,500 per student for the year. So I don't know what the $65,000 number was.
So it's a private sort of college as opposed to a public college.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for our institution, we run our tuition alone, excluding fees, is plus or minus about $7,500 a year for a full-time student, which is relatively low in comparison to our peers, even within the state, but also across states, particularly for engineering, healthcare-related fields. Our remissions, those sort of discounts and scholarships, run at about 11% of revenue for us, which is relatively low. And so we, as an institution, we have kind of a medium to low tuition level and a relatively low discount structure. As much as we can, try and focus those remissions in ways that support student access and student completion, particularly given the change in funding model that's focused on getting students through to completions.
Okay, thank you, Chair. The comment around non-residents, international students are among the non-resident population. So it's interesting for me to hear that they subsidize the fees. Can you tell me, in your institutions, do you guys have a number that you guys are recruiting for? Because I know you guys recruit for those specific students. Is there a set number that you're looking for? Is there a cap? Or is there a percentage per institution? Does that make sense?
Sure, Chair Ridden, Representative Alonso-Leon. We don't have a cap. We don't cap the number of students when we do actively recruit out-of-state students.
Chair Ridden, members of the committee, to be pretty direct, our institution has very few non-resident students. We, I believe, are the lowest proportion of non-resident students in the state. As I advise our institution, it will not be tenable for us to survive over the long term if we do not expand our enrollment base to pull in students from other states for the reasons that were outlined previously.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so I'm on the higher end in terms of institutions, and I can tell you we've looked at the figures, and if we were to dramatically reduce that, then we would have to raise resident tuition by an incredible amount to make up for that and be able to run the institution. So each campus is in a slightly different place based on their funding streams mm-hmm. and where they are with their state appropriation and other factors. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'd like to see. I'm on Ways and Means, so we'll be talking in Ways and Means. But committee, I think we're really getting out of hand. I think on especially international students. I know that my alumni they make it 75% in state, and it's University of North Carolina Chapel Hill, and they have a great endowment. They have one of the lowest costs for higher education, any university in that level. I think we got to bring the cost down. You know, we cannot continue to have the cost of education go like it's going. We've got to look at those 10,000 employees and see how many we need. Now, this legislature and ever the legislature, we put requirements on you to do that have to mean you have to add staff, so we need to look at that. But I've got a grandson coming up, and I don't know how he's going to afford this increase in education. So, and I don't know that the solution is to have more international students paying more than a lot more than in state residents. So, we're talking about affordability today, and. I think that I look for the leadership. We have great people in our universities and great managers and presidents. We need to look at making education more affordable. It doesn't always mean more revenue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dr. Solomon?
Thanks, Chair.
And we do need to close up pretty quick.
Okay. Just to clarify, though, because it's difficult, when I look at back at Mr. Cannon's presentation on the appropriations per student, it's difficult to compare, you know, the states, though, because there's such disproportionate investments in education, in higher education. So you're looking at Oregon is on the very bottom part of what we invest in higher education. I totally can, you know, speak to the fact I understand the cost of higher education is a huge concern. Absolutely, but I just think it's difficult when there's such disproportionate investments that we can't compare to that. So am I reading that wrong? Am I?
It's not a debate.
Yes,
we're not
I am
debating each
reading
other.
That wrong.
We could
yeah.
probably have lengthy discussions about
you don't
about
debate each
other.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will just share, and then I'm going to pass off to my colleague in the interest of, I know we have a short time frame, we have probably one more slide if we could share with you. There's absolutely no question that the differential levels of investments across the country make a huge difference on the budgets and the tuition rates and the mix of students. There's absolutely no question. Some states, and I believe North Carolina is one of them, have very impressive investments that they've been able to make, which enables them to do a lot of different things. So I'd like to just validate the statement that you made and pass off the final slide to my colleagues in the interest of timing.
So we had quite a few slides to explain how budgeting works, but I really want to just summarize that in our core budget that runs our universities, not anything outside of that, we are fundamentally dependent upon tuition revenue and state allocation, and they're both incredibly important. But when we look at just one institution and look at the cost drivers for next year, you can see them summarized. This is for PSU, but my colleagues have the same. You can see that the actually largest item that drives up our cost there in the core part of our university business is the retirement costs, about $5.2 million. Then the salaries and wages is the next largest item. And then minimum wage, which we talked about earlier, and we've not accounted for compression yet, but that's just about $700,000 mm-hmm. at our institution. And so when we look at really most of the costs, yes.
Could you explain compression to the committee? That's okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Chair and members of the committee. Compression is when you raise up the salary of some people to the point at which they bump up against people who are above them. So now we have employees who are being paid the same level as someone who oversees them. And so you create a compression problem.
Yeah.
So just in summary, I mean, the cost drivers at our institutions are somewhere about 4.2%, and so that's obviously much higher than, mm-hmm. and with the governor's recommended budget, which is flat, which the way the allocation comes, we get 49% in year one, 51% in year two, so we would see a decrease in allocation for our funding next year, but we have cost drivers, many of which are beyond our control. So the institutions are absolutely looking at significant cost-cutting measurements, but all the institutions, but that is why you are beginning to hear about significant tuition increases, too, because that's really the only way we can balance our budgets.
And would you confirm that what I'm reading is retirement PERS is more than your salary and wages?
That is indeed correct in our current modeling. In the second year of the biennium, it doesn't happen, right? But in the first year, when we have that step increase, that PERS is a higher cost driver for us than our salaries and wages.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Are we still going here? I'm going to get you one of those big foam hand things.
Especially for us. Committees, you really have to get the chairs.
Okay.
I appreciate your slide on cost drivers, and I also appreciate the number you have in the upper right-hand corner on every slide of your presentation, too. And I guess the point I would make is I think it's entirely possible for this legislature to get you what you're looking for there on the cost driver side, if we have the courage to take some actions. And I'll just point at PEB. I was talking to a couple of presidents who are in my office today, but I can remember back to 2011-12 when we had the number from the OUS system that said if we would allow the universities to go out on the open market and find insurance for their health care versus being in PEB, the saving was around $70 million. Not insignificant. Right.
Wow.
I just want to get that on the record and so forth.
That was Representative Jones. That was a biennial number.
Correct. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you so much. Really super helpful. We appreciate all you're doing, and appreciate your being here today. So I'm going to close this informational hearing. And we are back. And I'm opening a work session for the introduction of committee measures.
We can do that, Maury. You get that?
Yeah. Okay. I'm plugged. So, Rep. Alonzo Leon, may I have a motion, please?
Sure. Chair Reardon, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 3599, dated February 15, 2017. LC 3662, dated to February 16, 2017, LC 3663, dated February 16, 2017, LC 3664, dated February 16, 2017, LC 3665, dated February 16, 2017, and LC 4120, dated February 17, 2017.
Thank you. Alonzo Leon moves that LC 3599, dated 2/15/2017, LC 3662, dated 2/16/2017, LC 3663, dated 2/16/2017, LC 3664, dated 2/16/2017, LC 3665, dated 2/16/2017, and LC 4120, dated 2/17/2017. And, yeah, I just wanted to mention that LC 3599 comes to this committee from Rep. Johnson, and it is a concept that pertains to the transfer of credits. It's something we've all been eager to have a conversation about, and I take full responsibility for the remainder, and I would appreciate your, they are kind of placeholders that we may or may not use later on, so in this session, but...
Discussion.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I heard you say that your these bills are being introduced at your request.
They have.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Okay. Any objections? Hearing no objection, measures are introduced as committee bills. Okay, we have another member, Rep. Parrish, is on her way, and if you'd like to take a brief recess, get a little drink of water.
Oh, good, thanks.
And then we will get you out of here at 4:45. It's
this is beer and cheese.
There we go. Well, okay.
You're cheap. You just oh, you okay. Out on the party. So you think I'll bring the party?
No,
invite me to the right party.
Right, I'm not sure. Okay. Remember, we got everybody here. Nobody ran out.
Are you taking? Didn't have time.
Are you? Okay, members, we have one more public hearing today on a bill that looks at policy ideas for affordability. And on Thursday, we'll hear two other bills that relate to affordability, including the Open Educational Resources and Affordable Textbooks Bill. And I'd like to invite Rep. Parrish up. Thank you, Rep. Parrish.
Thank you.
And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2414. And no pressure, but I promised this committee that I would get them out on time.
Most of you know me. I talk pretty darn quick. So for okay. The record, House District 37, Julie Parrish, Westland and Tualatin, here on House Bill 2414, which is actually a redraft from a bill we did in 2015 or looked at in 2015 that I was a co-sponsor on with Representative John Davis. And I tried to see if he could come down today, but he was not available. So I'm flying solo here. We know that students coming out of our universities are swimming in debt. It is it's a shackle around people's checkbooks in a way that I think is keeping people in our state from being successful. It's money that is not going into our economy. It's going off into other places. And lots of states right now are trying to find ways to tackle the issue of student loan debt. I was a self-supporting student. It took me a lot of money to get a master's degree. And unfortunately, I still have a student loan payment, and it's not a fun payment to make. So this bill specifically, though, is also looking at folks. When we talked about this with people in the STEM community, they had some interest around how do you also incentivize folks to give back to their community while they're still also struggling to pay down these debts. So the bill does two things. In Section 2 of the bill, it looks at student loan debts for all Oregon students. So they have to be an Oregon resident. They have to have gone to an Oregon school. So really limiting this to our kiddos and not folks from other places. And it would look at creating a subtraction off of their income. The average national debt right now for students is about $30,000. The average payoff for that debt is about 21 years. It's a long time. So we're talking about an average of a $225 a month payment paid back at an average of 6.8% interest, which is tends to be where a lot of these student loans lie. It's $26,000 that's not going into our economy over the course of the life of their loan. So that long-term interest means that it's not being spent in our communities. It's not coming back into our tax base. And so at the beginning of that life of that loan, they're really looking at about a $1,900 subtraction for student loans. And, of course, amortized over 21 years, that number ultimately does decline. One of the other things that we looked at in this bill, and as we were talking to folks, Representative Davis and I, was that we wanted to really target people who took out loans during the recession. We know that we had a lot of older workers who had to take on student loan debt. And we know right now a government accountability audit from the federal government says that 114,000 seniors across our nation, I don't know specifically for Oregon, but seniors across our nation are having their Social Security checks debited for their student loans. So now we're talking about people who've also taken out loans and going into retirement, and they are just not able to keep up with this. And we believe that this is happening here in Oregon. So this first section of the bill, the section two, really is about trying to deal with all students in Oregon. The loan had to have been dispersed after December 31st, 2007. So we're not talking about people who've got loans from way back that are coming to the end. We're really talking about people who took on a lot of debt at a time when our public tuition was increasing at a pretty fast clip, and then they took on this debt so that they could, either as a young student or even as a returning student. The second piece deals with an issue that is close to my heart as somebody who cares about STEM. We know that voters just passed Measure 98, and we know that we're struggling to find people to go in and help sort of execute the teaching side of Measure 98. And so this would the second piece actually then says that we would give a credit up to 50% of the qualified interest for the year to people who commit to volunteering for STEM education. And so when you look at how many hours that is over the course of a year, a 6,000, if you did the high end of that loan or credit, sorry, if you did the high end of the credit based on the average debt, you're looking at about $7,000. But the number of volunteer hours you get is the equivalent to one FTE of STEM education. So a $6,900 investment to get an extra full body into STEM education versus maybe what the cost of hiring a teacher is. So the bill also allows for partial year residence. So you could maybe, say, live in Vancouver and have gone to an Oregon school, and then you move here in a tax year. Then you could then be a resident and claim that. We also have a sunset on this. So we're really trying to get to people who took out high-cost debt during the recession. And then, this bill would sunset if we passed it. It would sunset in 10 years. Lastly, we know that student loan cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. And so when you're talking about people trying to figure out how to pay crazy rents in Portland, or whether they're trying to pay for childcare, which we know is actually rapidly becoming almost as expensive as the cost of tuition, putting cash that somebody had earned back in their pocket so that they can have that to meet basic expenses is really important. This is unlike any other type of credit card debt, home debt, or anything that people take off and that they could go into a bankruptcy court if they were really struggling. We have chained people for a lifetime and even into their estates on student loan debt, and we need to give people some relief on this, and especially as we are not making the investments that I think we need to be making into higher education, and we're asking people also to stay here and work in Oregon. And other states are looking at these types of programs to attract folks into their communities, and I don't think we want our best and brightest to leave our state because they can't afford to live here. So student loan debt is something that I think we have a moral obligation to tackle and take on. It might not be in this session, but I think we need to start looking at what would this cost us. And the problem in the last, biennium is we didn't get a chance to get a fiscal on it. And so I know that there are folks who might come and say, we can't afford this, but we don't even know what this is. We don't know exactly what amount we're talking about, and we don't know what the opportunity cost and trade-off is if we don't make a change in how we do student loan debt. Interestingly, the STEM piece of this bill in Section 4 about volunteering and the opportunity cost of paying for a full FTE at full wages and full employment and full PERS and health care versus incentivizing volunteerism and helping people simultaneously pay down their debt has application in other fields. Now, this bill specifically was looking at STEM because we know that that is a place where voters really wanted us to go, and we were trying to be sort of ahead of how do you put STEM employees and people who have that skill and expertise into the opportunity to be working with kids in robotics or working with kids in aviation or any of these other STEM-type programs. But it also has application elsewhere. And just as an example, I mean, I think you could do something like this in healthcare. The governor right now has a goal of insuring an additional 17,000 kids, and that for $55 million a year on healthy kids. What would it look like if you incentivized through student loan reduction, and especially we know in the medical side, the huge cost that people are incurring to go into medical professions, what would it look like to incentivize charity care to get those kiddos? I mean, that might be a different way to solve the health care issue where you're trying to get kids access to health care. So I think that we need to start really rethinking how we're doing this. If we're not going to make the investments directly in the cost of reducing tuition, we have to free up folks on the back end somewhere where they're making these payments. And 21 years is a long time, and that's just an average. That's only if you're looking at a bachelor's degree. A lot of our STEM degrees require higher education. So now you're talking about taking on the cost of a master's and the programs for financial aid. When you're looking at a master's program, there's not a FAFSA form. I mean, you fill it out, but there's no Pell Grant for that. There's no needs grants for that. Now you're just taking out straight debt. So we know that folks in some of the STEM education professions are taking on much higher debt load to go into those fields, just as they are in healthcare. So that's why I also think this eventually has applicability for folks in healthcare profession. So with that, I will get us all out of here.
I think it's a really interesting concept, and I really like the idea of tying into volunteerism. Do you happen to have had a chance to figure out some examples of how much this would benefit somebody that has, say, a $30,000 loan making X amount per year?
Yeah.
Anything like that?
It's not necessarily X amount per year, because on the first part, it doesn't have an income qualification. It's just a straight deduction, put money back into your pocket. And so, I mean, certainly based on some of the other things about, I mean, this is a Schedule A deduction, and I'm not a tax accountant by trade, but it's a Schedule A deduction for them. And so the interest at the beginning of that life of that loan, if the $30,000 average held true, is about $1,983. It would be a subtraction from their income. So depending on how much income, minus your subtraction, and that starts sort of where you start counting down on your taxes is how that would work. The credit is a little bit different. That is a dollar-for-dollar credit. It's not refundable. So when we get it down to the Revenue Committee and people want to talk about refundable tax credits, you can't get more back than you didn't pay, so it's not refundable. Right. It's also neither is a carry forward. So if you don't take it in this tax year, the tax year that you earned it, you don't come back and get to amend your taxes, and you don't get to carry it forward. It's just in the year that you achieve those hours. There's a piece in here about then what is STEM on the STEM credit. We envisioned, Representative Davis and I sort of envisioned this working a little bit like how when you submit your $75 reimbursement to the from the Home Depot for your wash machine to the Energy Trust and they mail you back a rebate, that we could work with the HEC and the STEM Council to create the criteria that says this is what qualified STEM education is, and this is where you meet that criteria. And if you have met that criteria, then that is your documentation for taking that type of tax credit on your tax.
Okay. A couple of quick questions. Anybody? Rep. Johnson.
Thanks, Representative, for the bill. I've got an LC that's very similar, not as specific to STEM, because, frankly, there's other occupations that I wish we could also incentivize, you know. Beginning of school this year, we had four school teachers living in vans in my district because they couldn't afford housing. But not to mention, you know, you look at what they're making and so forth, and obviously I would love to see us incentivize more folks going into teaching profession too, because it's just with the high cost of housing in certain communities, it's just untenable anymore. So that, but the 2007 date was just kind of something you and Rep. Davis just kind of thought about as a pre-recession thing, but I'm just wondering about that. You know,
and that's really where
real scientific, I guess.
That's really where that came from. We said we looked at the fact where people, where our cost of higher ed started to really take an uptick at the same time that more people were going back into, you know, particularly community college, but going out and taking those loans as they were losing their jobs in the workforce. I mean, My loans were incurred back in the 90s for some of them, and I'm, you know, collectively between my master's degree and my bachelor's degree, and it took 8 years to get a bachelor's degree, that I still have some stuff that's outstanding from that far back. So you could have gone back pretty darn far, but we wanted to at least sort of cap a little bit of this cost, and we recognize that that recession downturn was a good starting point to have the conversation and not make it so expansive that it's not doable.
And then the non-resident portion, would these be they are taxpayers, so they're
taxpayers.
Paying taxes, but they're not living here, so they could be employed in Oregon, live in Vancouver or what, so, okay.
Because they're going to pay an Oregon tax return.
Sure, so. Okay. All right. Yeah, well, thanks. Appreciate that.
Okay. I don't see any further questions.
Right.
I'm going to close this informational hearing. Do I have to say on House Bill 2414? And at 4 minutes early, I'm closing a meeting of the Ohio Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. And Workforce Development Committee.